We had a couple of very, very generous people who contributed greatly to the cost that it does cost us to get someone like Simon here, clear from Australia. And we're very grateful for that. And it's just been a thrill to think of him coming, because I know so many people are new and didn't hear his presentation, which I think, believe, was 3 years ago. Was it three or four? I think it was three. At which time he had not published his book yet, but was in the process of writing it. And since then, we know the impact that it's had. And so without further ado, I would like to turn the time over to Simon.
Is this operating? I can't whisper, can I? I've got this thing.
Yeah. Did you have one?
No.
Okay. So, this is for your slide. It's not working.
It hasn't got a point on it, has it?
You have the laser
button. Oh, right. The big button. Right.
Right here.
No.
We'll get it.
Yep, that's on. Right. Well, this is really a pleasure to be here today. I've been thoroughly enjoying the sort of alpine scenery, and I was up at Snowburn. There's some hands raising. Is that any better? Is that any better? Can we turn the volume up? Okay, I'll try and scream. Yeah, I've been really enjoying the alpine scenery and the but the altitude gets to me, and it dried out my lips, and it's probably going to dry out my throat as I speak. But firstly, I'd want to thank a few people. I really need to thank Sue, who's done an enormous amount of work to get me here. The anonymous donors, I have a clue about some of them, but I really appreciate them funding my visit. And I'm also grateful for, I just want to mention a couple of other people. There are so many, I'm going to offend those who I don't mention, but Stephen Clark's been a Adelaide Lampoon cricket, has been a long time buddy and pal, and we've got up to a lot of interesting things over the years, and he was a great help during the writing of the book. Richard Packham also was a great help there. He reviewed the whole book as well, made some very useful comments. Tom Kimball is also, I think he's here in the audience, hiding up the back probably, and he's been a very close friend and a great help through the writing of it. It was the most difficult thing I've done writing the book, because it took 5 years of my spare time, not all of my spare time, but an awful chunk of it, and I think there were consequences for the family as a result of that, but we've got over it, and the family, I don't think, has ever been happier. So we're really thrilled with our current situation, despite all the things we've been through. I just thought I'd make a couple of comments about the title of my talk, which was hastily put together under great pressure from Sue, who's really good at... She always seems to be on the net. Every time I send an email, doesn't matter what time of the day or night, I get an instant response from Sue. but you'll notice the title of my book is slightly different. It's Losing a Lost Tribe from the title of my talk, Losing a Lost Race. And Losing a Lost Race was my first choice, in fact, for the title of the book. And if anyone's here published a book, you know that publishers have the last word when it comes to titles of book. And we had a real tussle for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, during which, you know, the author said, "I'll stuff you guys, I'll go somewhere else." I'm very glad that I didn't. Signature Books has been really fantastic, particularly Ron Pritis in the editing stage. So I don't want to talk all about the science, because even for me, you know, science gets boring after a while. I know that a lot of you are very interested in, I guess, what led me to the discovery of the science, and some of the things that have happened since I left the church and the publication of the book, and some of you may have heard of my excommunication last year. So I'm happy to talk about the excommunication, but I'm conscious that what's recorded today is going to go onto the internet, and Farms and Fair will be amongst the first people who listen to my talk, and I think there might be elements that I'd rather talk about after I've sort of finished and said, that's the end of my talk, and then we have the question period. You can ask anything you like. Okay, I'm not afraid to talk about my excommunication and all the inappropriate things that I've done in my life since leaving the church. I'll talk about... Ask me about my last talk in 2002 after I finished my talk. Yeah. Because there's things I don't want to tell now. Okay, I joined the church in 1970 when I was 10, so I was essentially a convert to the church. Our family was living in Sydney, and we used to go to the Anglican church, and quite a few of my brothers and sisters spent most of their time in church counting the bricks in the beautiful, beautiful brick arches in this church. Dad was just, he's getting sick and tired of the Anglican church because we had, at the time, 7 children. And we took up one entire pew and we were restless. And he had a few falling outs with the Anglican priest. And so when the missionaries came along, he was just a little bit more inclined to listen. And so I was thrilled to join the church because it was, at the time, it was flourishing, it was modern, brand new church, it was exciting. And I formed a really good friend straight away. In fact, I found out afterwards he was assigned to our family, assigned to be a friend to me. I hope that I've formed friendships in the church that haven't been assigned to me. But I won't reveal this guy's name, but he was a very close friend for a couple of years when we lived in Sydney. I received an email from him about 2 years ago. He lives in Hawaii. He's left the church. And he is so hurt and damaged by the church that he couldn't even maintain a correspondence with me. It just raised too many hurtful issues from his past. But he's very happy in Hawaii. He's married a lovely woman and they're happily settled there. So I don't think I helped him to leave the church, but it's been really good to get that contact back. A few years after we joined the church, we moved to the western suburbs of Sydney. My father really wanted to get out onto acreage, and that suited me fine because I was I liked gardening, and one of the things that got me going, and probably the key thing that got me going in gardening and growing plants and my interest in plants was the fact that my father encouraged me to grow radishes. And for those of you who've grown plants, radishes are one of the easiest things to grow, and they're about the quickest. It's about, I think, 6 or 8 weeks or something in the middle of the summer. You'll have something to eat. Well, usually it was a very thin red radish for me, but it was quick enough for me to get interest and get interested in plants. Interestingly, the most studied plant in the world now is a member of the radish family. It's a plant called Arabidopsis, which is a tiny little weed, and was the focus of a conference that a large focus, I guess, of the conference that I'm also attending up in Snowbird, which is just finishing today. That's about plants and how plants move gas between the inside of the leaves and the atmosphere, which is a very important topic at the moment because of climate change, CO2 levels changing, things like that. And so I'm not an expert in that field, but it was just... We want to work in that field because in forestry it's very important to develop trees that use less water to make the same amount of wood, because water is becoming extremely scarce in Australia. There were a lot of Australians at this meeting. So anyway, not that's a diversion. But anyway, I got really interested in plants. But one of the other nice things about being in the western suburbs was meeting another of my best friends. And that's Gary Rogers, who's in the audience. Gary and I were good buddies for years and years at Nepean High School. About a year separated us in age, so I was usually the deacon's corn president. He was the first advisor, and up into the teachers and the priests. But we Gary's a very bright guy. He works for Cisco now, and he spends half his life, I think, in the US. Is that right, Gary? Sorry? Close, okay. Gary is actually OzGaz for those who hang about, spend too much time on RFM. I must admit, or confess, I guess I must confess to a bit of inactivity as far as RFM is concerned. I haven't been reading as much as I perhaps should. But then that's probably a good sign. I might add, Deborah is also here, Gary's wife. So Gary and I were good mates, but I was a pretty average student. In fact, I failed agriculture at the higher school certificate, which is the university entrance exam in Australia. And so I decided to study agriculture at university and get my act together. So I got into the University of Sydney in the lowest 5% of students. During my time there, halfway through my degree, I spent a two-year mission in Melbourne. And in fact, it was my mission, if anything, that turned around my academic career. Now, I'm not sure whether it's the church held me back before my mission, but when I came back from my mission, I found it very much easier to study because I was a fairly diligent missionary and I studied hard and I memorized the discussions. We had to know pages and pages and pages of discussions, word perfect. And in the Melbourne mission, we had this some sort of a special missionary program where you got a hole drilled in your tag and gold paint put in a circle. So you're a special missionary if you could recite every discussion word perfect in one sitting. So that's how serious they were, and so I was very proud to be one of those missionaries. But it was on my mission, in fact, that I don't think I ever really questioned, but President Kimball was the prophet at the time, and I loved him, and I'm sure a lot of you love him as well as you're growing up in your teens. He was a great man in my eyes, and what he drilled into me was to read the Book of Mormon, because that was really the key to knowing, to your testimony, and to knowing that the church was true. And in fact, I completed reading the Book of Mormon for the second time on the plane into the mission field. And I knew it was true because I had felt so good as I read the book. But I spent the first 3 months of my mission every night praying for a witness that the Book of Mormon was true. And I just reached sort of the depths of despair because I had not received a witness. And I couldn't figure it out. You know, here's a guy who wants to get the witness, working his butt off in the mission field, doing everything he can, and I can't get a witness. What have you got to do? And so I went and saw the mission president, and he said, oh, look, you know, we receive our witnesses in all sorts of ways. If you felt that prompting as you're reading the book, then that's it. And so I even contacted my bishop, who was my brother-in-law, who's now the head of the art gallery here in BYU, a very faithful member, a wonderful guy. And, he wrote me this really long letter because he sensed that I was questioning the truthfulness of the church. And I wasn't questioning, I was just frustrated because I ought to be able to see that answer. But anyway, the answer from the mission president was fine for me. And I pretty much swept it under the carpet. And I served a faithful mission, went home at 2 years. I had the choice. I could have come home at 18 months. I don't know whether any of you know that, but there was a period when just a few months, a lot of missionaries had a choice. And for some, it was a pretty painful choice. Some of them, they took the ticket and left straight away. I was pretty keen to stay. I think I served a two-year, one-month mission, in fact. Gosh, it was too serious. Anyway, I got home from my mission, and Australia beat America in the America's Cup. I don't know if you know too much about the America's Cup. It's a boat race. Australia's not all that interested in it anymore because we don't win it anymore. But it's a boat race that Australia, well, no one had won apart from the Americans. It was widely perceived to be something that was rigged and nobody could ever win. In fact, Australia was about three down. And then they won every race in a row and then won the America's Cup. And the whole country went totally nuts. And I just couldn't believe the rush of emotion that I could feel. And I thought to myself, gee, this is a very similar emotion that I'm feeling. In fact, it's a much more powerful emotion than I was feeling about the Book of Mormon. So I started thinking, gee, these feelings, are these terribly reliable? So anyway, I put that aside. And I was a pretty faithful member from then on. I served in heaps of young men's presidencies, probably six or seven. Served in heaps of bishoprics. I hopped around a lot as a scientist, do what they call postdocs. You do a doctorate, and then you 2 year or 3 year stints in different places. So we went to England, had a great time there. And when I reached England, just remembered that I'd been through a postdoc, and I still didn't actually accept the scientific evidence that I had in front of me was convincing enough that evolution was actually a real principle, really true. And I'm totally convinced that evolutionary theory is a valid, very valid explanation for how things have turned out on the planet. But yeah, I just remember having a good old argument with a guy in England about evolutionary theory. He was a member of the Community of Christ. He was a reorg, as we called him in those days. The Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ. Anyway, so as I sort of, here we go, time. I'm not getting, okay, tons, okay. I didn't have an awful lot of doubts. I had a few things that bugged me every now and then. But I pretty much stuck with it. But I certainly remember feeling just utterly depressed when the state president called me into his office and called me as the bishop of Anagra Ward, which had just split, and a new ward, Bunya Forest, this is in Brisbane, the western suburbs of Brisbane, was formed. And because I'd been in enough bishoprics to know that being a councillor is a picnic, because the bishop really takes the load. All of the emotional load he generally takes. The next worst calling is an Elderscorn president. I can sympathise with anyone here who's... I was never an Elderscorn president. That's the one thing I'm really grateful for, because that's a really tough one. So I was serving as a bishop. There were times when I got really frustrated. We had a CES guy come up. I sort of regard them as the brown shirts in the church. This guy, just Nazis, total Nazis, and they like to tell bishops how things should be done. You know, I was the bishop of the ward. I knew what was going on in the youth program. I knew how sensitive our youth were to things that shifts in seminary classes and whatnot. He wanted to make two seminary classes, whereas all of the kids that were in the two wards went to the same high school, except that we only had four youth and the other ward had 25. So it made a heck of a lot of sense to have all of the youth together at the same seminary class going to the same high school. This guy told me that he didn't tell me directly. He announced in a bishop's training meeting that it was very important that every ward had their own seminary class. And I know there are some bishops here who are resisting this, but we feel this is in front of all the bishops in the stake and the stake presidency. And I was mightily pissed off. And anyway, but I suppressed that. Another thing that happened was one day we had a bishop's training meeting, and stake president said, "Now, bishops, I don't want you to tell this to anybody outside this room, but women are no longer to give closing prayers in sacrament meeting." And I thought to myself, gee, I've got some really nice women in my ward, and I've got a lot of fruitcakes in the priesthood. That doesn't make any sense to me. And I stewed on it for a little while, and then I just sort of timidly, because I was a fairly timid sort of guy, I think, at the time. I timidly sort of asked the state president, and I said, you know, we've got some wonderful sisters in my ward. I feel just, you know, it seems a bit odd. Can you tell us why? And did, you know, I asked him, did you ask these guys, the very presidencies, why? And he just sort of looked at me and said, I didn't even think to ask why. And it just was that sort of unquestioning, blind obedience that just started to build up and drive me nuts. There was another case. Another little thing, I can't remember anyway, it's gone. So, I read an article in the Ensign, it was 98, just by Donald Parry. And it was an article that basically said to me that if you didn't believe that there was a universal flood on the planet 4,500 years ago, you were a less than faithful Latter-day Saint. And for me, that was right. That was the one that just pushed me over the limit. And I thought, no, that's a bit... I'm working pretty hard as a bishop. I don't need this in the Ensign. I don't need to be told that I'm less than faithful. So I... And just by the way, Donald Parry was absolutely blasted by heaps of BYU scholars. He got nailed after that by Farms and quite a few other scholars who know that there's no evidence for a universal flood 4,500 years ago. But I had to have some sort of release. I wanted to be able to talk to other members and that had these concerns. And I think in Utah, you've got lots of other drawbacks. Believe me, being in Utah with lots of Mormons, that's a hassle. In Australia, I never run into them. But there were probably more avenues for somebody in Utah to be able to talk to other people. Like you can go to BYU, for example, and talk to scientists. I couldn't go to BYU. I didn't know anyone there. Plus, I was 12,000 miles away in Australia, so it was very difficult. And I had never mixed in the Sunstone circles, the sort of fringe... Because in Australia, if you read Sunstone, you're on the way to apostasy. No two ways about it. Amongst all of the people, senior leaders I knew, that's what they thought. If you started to get too academic about the Book of Mormon, even reading dialogue, even any sort of academic stuff related to the Book of Mormon and or the Doctrine and Covenants or the Book of Abraham was very frowned on. So... There was a guy in my ward clerk, in fact, was a molecular biologist like me. He was working on plants. In fact, he was working upstairs in the building where I was working at the time. And we were just sort of chatting in the state, in the clerk's office, and sort of confessing to each other that we accepted evolutionary theory, basically. That was almost what we were doing. And his wife happened to go pop her head into the office, and she didn't say anything, but she heard enough. She heard the word evolution, and she promptly walked off. I didn't know this was what was going on, but she spoke. She was the best mates of the State Relief Society president. She spoke to the State Relief Society. You know how it goes in the church. Things move real quick. And the state president, who is a wonderful guy, pulled me aside a week afterwards. He said, look, you know, I know you're a scientist, but can you not talk about evolution in the church? He was such a nice guy, and I felt very comfortable with accepting his counsel. But I went away and I sort of stewed on it. I thought, I can't even talk to anybody because I can't talk to people at church. And I think it'd be uncomfortable if I was talking to them outside of church. And so I went on the internet. And the thing that I was searching for on the internet was not DNA evidence. I was searching for something intelligent written by a Latter-day Saint that supported the flood. And I spent days and days, and there's nothing. There was nothing that I could find. And I don't think there's anything that's been written that's sort of... I think Dwayne Jeffrey may have written something. Does anyone know that for sure? Oh, okay. It's on the web? Okay. I might have seen a draft. I think I saw a draft or a talk or something. Yep, but it's only recently. Sorry? Okay, yeah. Okay, so it has been published. And if Duane Jeffrey wrote it, it's worth reading. Okay, he's a wonderful guy. So anyway, I got on the net and couldn't find anything with that. But as you do, I was a scientist and I used a search engine called PubMed, which is a great one for searching up research papers. And I typed in Native Americans and searched on there. And lo and behold, up popped a couple of research papers on the DNA of Native Americans. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I printed off a couple of these. I took them home at night and I read them. And after a few days, I showed them to my wife. I sort of basically explained what it was about, and I just sort of leave it there, and she would read the abstracts. Jane is she's not a scientist, but you know, when you live with somebody for 20 years, you pick up a few things, and she's an English teacher, and so she, I guess, wasn't too long before she realized, I guess, the importance of the data. But it was 2 weeks. I was reading the research for 2 weeks. By the end of 2 weeks, I knew without a doubt that Native Americans were descended from Asians. They were not descended from Israelites. Interestingly, I knew without a doubt that the Book of Mormon was true, and I also knew without a doubt that Native Americans were descended from Israelites. That's called cognitive dissonance. Is it George Orwell that called it doublethink? Is it Orwell? Yeah. I was an absolute basket case of it. So I remember on the 2nd of August 1998, we had a family home evening with I'm not even sure if it was a Monday, but we sang a song with our kids that night. It was Book of Mormon Stories. After that, I thought to myself, yep, we're not going to sing that one again. I mean, that's a stereotype. The beat of it is just tom-tom. It's Native American. It's offensive, totally offensive to Native Americans. I went to bed, and I was still a believing Mormon, totally devout, and I woke up, and it was completely resolved. My thought processes were completely gone as a devout Latter-day Saint. I knew it was wrong, and that's about all I knew. I knew the evidence was right. I had I think I had a nightmare maybe a day later where I thought, oh gosh, I've got this all wrong. It can't be. I've misinterpreted it. But I went over it and over it and over it again, and I'm totally convinced there is no Israelite ancestor there. Certainly haven't found any yet, except in tribes that had migrants from Spain or somewhere where there were large numbers of Jews that migrated to the Americas. Just one other thing I was a bishop, that was a problem. You can't not believe in the Book of Mormon. Well, I guess you can. The stories I've heard here are just amazing. The number of bishops out there that don't believe that it's a historical document is just amazing. And the number of stake presidents, I think it's just going to go higher and higher. But in my little world over there, the only conclusion I could reach is I can't be a bishop and not believe this book. And so I arranged to have a meeting with the stake president within about a day. Instead of going to church, and so I described the evidence to him. He was wonderful. He never questioned my integrity the whole time. None of the stake presidents, he questioned my integrity. It was only when I went to area leaders and higher up farms, that's when they start to question your integrity. They still do it. They do it all the time in their publications. And I think it's absolutely appalling. So anyway, instead of going to church the next Sunday, I had a meeting with the stake presidency, and that's when I outlined a few things to them. And they asked me a few questions. One of them had Polynesian ancestry, so he didn't think there were any pure Polynesians left. And so I answered their questions. There was a guy in Brisbane who was connected to farms, and they spoke to him. They thought that he might be able to help. And within days, I received a fax under the title of John Tvetnis and Scott Woodward at BYU, this article that rebutting critics of the church who were criticizing on the basis of DNA evidence. And I was totally shocked because I hadn't criticized. I wasn't a critic. I didn't see myself as a critic of the church. And it turns out that Scott Woodward was not even aware of that publication. His name was on it. Tevednis had just had a conversation with him about the DNA research, and Scott was quite disappointed that how that came about. Scott Woodward was a professor of microbiology at the time at BYU, and I was put in touch with Scott by the Area Presidency. Another interesting little aside was that the Area Presidency heard about my release as the bishop and by word of mouth, by gossip, and then wrote a letter to me criticising me for my what I'd done and threatening all sorts of consequences, usual stuff that they send to many hundreds and thousands of members, saying that my family's going to suffer because of my what I've done, the eternal consequences for people around me and my family and all this sort of stuff, trying to scare me. And I was so horrified by this letter, a letter from an area president acting on hearsay, that I wrote back to him. And I took him to task. And I actually have an apology letter from an area president, believe it or not, that came a few weeks later. So, but I spoke to, I had a fair degree of email correspondence with Scott, but he was quite busy at the time traveling to South America, sampling Native American tribes and whatnot. But we had sort of a scientific tussle, I guess, for the first exchange for the first few emails. And it was in those emails that he told me that he'd DNA tested 6,500 Native Americans from Peru. And about 98% of their DNA lineages came from Asia. So there was 2% they weren't sure where they came from. But 98% were from Asia. And Scott told me that he'd really struggled with the evidence. He'd struggled for 2 or 3 years. And he'd reached the conclusion that Lehi had made a fairly minor impact in the New World, and that we don't really know where his descendants are. And I thought, well, that's all well and good for you as a academic at BYU, but I'm at the coalface. He was actually at the coalface too, but he was in a BYU ward. He was a bishop of the BYU ward. But I had more Lamanites. I know more Lamanites than he probably knows. Because the Polynesians are Lamanites. This is the way I thought, you know. That's the way all Polynesians feel in Australia. They're Lamanites. They're descended from the Book of Mormon people via Hagoth and all the folks that hopped on those big boats. And so I wrote, well, that's pretty much where the communication ended with Scott, because I wrote back to him and I said, look, you know, your explanation is just ridiculous. Because it's just not going to satisfy the members of the church. And I guess what happened then was that I started reading the farms material, and I started to get a sense of, okay, this is how they're going to handle the DNA. If they're going to handle the same, you know, the way Nibley handled the Book of Abraham, and Sorensen handles the limited geography, if they're going to handle the DNA evidence the same way, it ain't worth talking to them. And so I just went quiet. And we slowly drifted out of the church. In fact, I told quite a few people and they left before me. In the other ward that was formed, I told a guy in the bishopric there, look, I'm having a few troubles, I'm being released next week. I want you to at least defend my reputation. I'm leaving for these reasons, not for anything else. And a couple of days later, he rings me up and says, I want to know the reasons you're leaving. He wanted to see the research himself. And took it home, showed his wife. 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, I think they left. I became a primary teacher. I was released as bishop. Became a primary teacher. Because I was just so blown away, I didn't know which way was up. And we then moved. It wasn't too long before I thought, gee, this is great, missing out all these meetings. Why don't I just skip out in a few more? And I stopped going. My wife, Jane, hung on a bit longer. She was always a few weeks, about a 2 or 3 or a month behind me in her sort of dealing with the evidence and the consequences of the Book of Mormon and her testimony, those sorts of things. She also felt an enormous sense of obligation to the folks in primary, so she helped there until we left Brisbane, because I just took up a job at CSIRO, which is where I'm at now. And we went to Canberra, and we went into anonymity. Even though we lived in Canberra before as members of the church, we didn't hear a peep from the church for 6 or 7 years. 6 years, I think it was. No home teachers. No, we were one of those do not visits. We hadn't even requested it. they just didn't want. They didn't want to know us. So they. So, I think I might switch on the PowerPoints now, and I'll run through the DNA evidence. I've got about 39 slides. I hope it doesn't take 39 minutes. Normally, you spend a minute on each slide. Bob, that might come in handy next time you give a talk, Bob. It's, where is he? But, I could have sat there for 3 hours, honestly. I don't know why they didn't let him keep going. He was fantastic. so we're going to switch on the PowerPoint projector. I'll just take the cap off, is that right? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Well, I've got nothing to say. so I'll run through the while I'm on the topic, I was thoroughly enjoyed Linda Walker's talk, and again, as a scientist, I feel I can't help but see the science fitting in there with the enormous increase in genetic disorders amongst people who marry very, very closely related people. What you might be interested to know is that we all have defective genes. Every single one of us has defective genes. The nice thing is that we very rarely have two copies of the defective gene. Okay, we've got about 60,000 genes, something like that. Not many more than plants. You might be interested to know. In fact, I think that 60,000 is probably coming down, if anything, so we're much more closely related than you think. But we have two copies of every gene, okay? And sometimes both of them function. Sometimes only one is necessary to do all the work of that particular gene. But if you have two copies of the same gene that are defective, then you're in strife. Scientists refer to this as genetic load. And these genes are called lethal. The ones that kill, that result in stillbirths, will be known as a lethal gene, but there are other disease-causing genes as well. And so if you start marrying related people, the nice thing about if you marry somebody that's distantly related is that you very, very rarely have, the mutations in the same genes. Okay, so you'll usually have a good copy, okay, and the backup sitting there probably not doing an awful lot. But when you marry somebody who's related, they have the same mutations in the same genes. And so when those people marry, the chances of two genes with the same mutation, the same error occurring in the one individual increases dramatically. Very, very. So if there's a fairly high level of genetic disorders amongst living people in polygamous communities, then I suspect there would be a much, much higher incidence of stillbirth. So it all, I guess that's the genetic perspective of a very, very tragic situation that has arisen because of polygamy. It looks like my slides. Okay, I don't want to put too many people asleep here, so I'm going to quickly go through this and hopefully make it as painless as possible. I don't want you to feel like you're back in high school, and there won't be a test afterwards. There might be a test for me, though, because I can't see the buttons. Oh, that one. Oh, okay. Okay, so this is the basic structure of DNA. You can see it's a No, that's not. That's gonna. There it is. Okay, it's a double helix. The structure of this molecule was only worked out about 50 years ago. So the amount of information that we've learnt that's been accumulated in the time since we've discovered the sequence of this, or the structure of this molecule was discovered, is just absolutely enormous. But it's a long chain-like molecule, and it contains our genetic information. And there are essentially four letters, well there are four compounds in DNA that just go by these letters, A, C, G, and T, and it just stands for the chemical name, and you don't need to know that. The genetic information is stored in the linear order of those DNA letters. Okay, you can make an enormous amount of, you can store an enormous amount of information in that sequence. You just change that next letter you add on and it's just astronomical. Our genes are just short segments of this long, long stretch of DNA. And they usually have 500 to 3,000 letters in them. And they code for proteins. This DNA sequence codes for a protein. When we have a gene, a lot of our DNA is thought of as junk. Okay, if you added up all of the total sequence that codes for protein, it's just a fraction, a tiny fraction of our DNA. There's a lot of other stuff out there, which scientists call junk DNA until they figure out, well, hang on, there's a lot of other stuff going on we don't know about. So it's very interesting. So it's fairly short, discrete units are called, these genes are really what make us. These make the protein, they make our skin, they make the enzymes. And we have about 60, I think it's, I'm probably wrong on that one, I'm not up to speed on the latest with humans, but I think it's in the order of 60,000, 50 or 60,000. The Arabidopsis, they sequence the entire Arabidopsis, that's that plant I told you about, it's this very tiny genome, they sequence the entire genome, and at first they thought it had 25,000 genes, and then they've just revised that upwards to about 5,000, so there could be many more genes in there, and maybe so with humans. Okay, this is where our DNA lives. Okay, every cell of our body has a nucleus. Inside the nucleus are our chromosomes. We have 44 chromosomes, as well as an X chromosome, and in the case of males, a Y chromosome. Okay, but we have a tiny piece of DNA that doesn't live in the nucleus. And that has consequences for how that DNA is passed on during sexual reproduction. Okay, this piece of DNA, mitochondrial DNA, which is contained in these energy-making factories, is only passed on from mother to offspring. Okay, so that's an interesting thing to keep in mind. And we'll come back to it. We might even come back to it on the next slide. I don't know. Okay, so this is how our DNA is inherited. Okay, Y chromosome, obviously from the father. I haven't got the X chromosome up here, and it's buried in this 23. But males have an X and a Y and an X. Females have an X and an X. As I said, the mitochondrial DNA is passed to both boys and girls. There might be very, very rare cases where you get paternal transfer, but it's so rare that scientists are completely convinced that it's irrelevant in terms of genealogical work that's come since then. But you'll notice that the colours of these four, okay, this represents matching chromosomes. You know, I was talking about we all have two copies of a gene. That's because we have two copies of the same chromosome. One gene sits on exactly the same place on each chromosome. Okay? But you'll notice that the offspring here have inherited, on each one of these chromosomes, have inherited chunks from the mother and chunks from the father. And same with the other chromosome. And that's because of a process called recombination. It's when the chromosomes line up during division of the, or copying of the DNA and cellular division, there's a time when they exchange. They'll exchange bits, whole chunks of chromosomes will be exchanged between each other, and that's why we don't all look like, exactly like clones of our parents, or one of our parents. But this creates an enormous challenge for scientists, though, when they're studying genealogy using DNA, tracking the DNA on the chromosomes, because it gets mixed up every generation. You can see here it gets even worse if you start looking at a few generations. Now these are mixtures of all of the grandparents on the Y, on the what they call the autosomal. You don't even know that. But that's on all the chromosomes. But you'll see that the mitochondrial DNA is faithfully handed down the maternal line, and the Y chromosome is faithfully handed down the paternal line. And that's just illustrated. Okay, so because of that unique pattern of inheritance, the Y chromosome coming down the paternal line, the mitochondrial coming down the maternal line, scientists have been using it to study genealogy because it's inherited just like surnames are. And so it's pretty much exactly the same. And written into that DNA are sort of molecular surnames, if you like. There are molecular codes, information in the DNA. And this is how that information occurs. This is a mitochondrial genome which has about 6,500 letters in it. Okay, and they're in a circle. That's, the chromosomes are one long line. But the mitochondrial DNA is a complete circle, 16,500 letters of DNA. And this here shows, I guess, a close-up of one of these points where there's, in one individual there might be an A at that position, but another individual there might be a G at that position, and saying C and T substitutions there. So you can imagine, apart from these changes, the entire sequence, when you look at different individuals, is exactly the same. So I would say amongst Caucasians sitting in this room, most of you would have less than 10 differences in that 16,000 odd letters in the mitochondrial genome. But that's extraordinarily valuable genetic information, even if it's only 10 bases. 10, like to say bases, that's the letters of the DNA. The Y chromosome is a little bit more complex. Less complex in terms of genes, because there's hardly anything on it that's of much use. Because a lot of people in this room get away without them, quite happily. Women don't have any Y chromosomes at all. So, I think one of the major genes on the Y chromosome is the sex-determining gene, because it's the Y chromosome that controls whether or not you're a male or you're a female. We have a single Y chromosome in each cell for males. I guess the other point I didn't make on that mitochondrial slide is those little factories, those mitochondria in the cell have many copies. There are many copies of the mitochondria, and there are many copies of the mitochondrial DNA, so there's just a lot of DNA in mitochondria. But in each cell, there's only one copy of the Y chromosome DNA, and that has consequences for trying to isolate Y chromosome DNA from very ancient material. You might have heard a bit about determining the DNA in ancient material. They can do it with mitochondrial, but not with Y chromosome at this stage, because it's just, there's only one copy there in each cell, and it's pretty scarce. But what the Y chromosome does have is just truckloads of genealogical information. There are hundreds of DNA changes occurring, which you can use to distinguish from other lineages, and I'll show that a bit more clearly in the next slide. People that are related to you have fewer differences in their DNA. Okay, so we can tell from these two mitochondrial lineages here. Sorry, these ones here, that they're more closely related to each other than they are, both of them are, to that one. Because these ones have this mutation at this point. These are just those A, G spelling changes on the mitochondrial DNA. Okay? So, this DNA is very powerful for telling us how lineages are related. So if you had a mitochondrial DNA that didn't have any of these spelling changes, say these five ones here, we could conclude that they're fairly distantly related. Okay, if we go to the other thing that, it's not working, there might be a head in the way. Is there a head in the way? Oh, here we go. Now I've got to go back. Okay. I sort of mentioned it, but the DNA spelling changes or mutations, whatever you call them, like to call them, accumulate over time. And based on the number of spelling changes that occur, you can determine how long ago two lineages had a common ancestor. It's like a clock. They refer to this as the molecular clock. These mutations might be occurring by random, but over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, that randomness actually isn't entirely random. There's a common sort of rate of these changes occurring. So it can tell us how old lineages are. And this is a mitochondrial DNA lineage family. If you look down here on the right, you can see that some of these lineages are really quite old. Okay? They first occurred 60,000 years ago. And they can determine that by the number of the mutations that have occurred. I'm not going to talk a lot about Y chromosomes today, but they've done the same thing with Y chromosomes. They've been able to build these big family trees of related Y chromosomes. And this tree is actually fairly similar to the one before, but it's just drawn more pretty. I don't think it's your head now. It's my glass of water. Okay. So scientists, back in about 1989, started looking at the DNA genealogies of Native Americans. And what they found was that they shared their DNA, their mitochondrial DNA lineages fell into four very large but distinct groups that had very common spelling changes in their DNA. Not long afterwards, they discovered another lineage called the X lineage. So we have the A, B, C, D, and X lineage. There are also other lineages that they've found. I don't know where I put the screen on. Okay. They found in Ecuador, they found a fairly unusual lineage that occurs at quite high frequency in a population there. But they've also found in that population that it has spelling changes that are unique to Asian populations. But they've also found a smattering of European and African lineages amongst Native Americans. So they've DNA tested now about 8,500 Native Americans, and these have been surveyed from about 200 tribes, and about 99.5% of their DNA lineages fall into the A, B, C, D, and X lineage family. And they're closely related to Asian, to lineages found in Asian populations. This illustrates the sort of number of tribes. This is out of date, this slide. A lot more tribes have now been analyzed. It's in excess of 200. Peru was a population that they had very little data on. It's interesting that I don't think we're going to see that data ever. 6,500 Native Americans, and we won't know their lineages. That's a bit unfortunate, but there is a very large project underway, and that's funded by National Geographic and I think IBM, and they're going to be DNA testing about 100,000 individuals from around the world, and they're going to be doing a lot of Native Americans, so I'm sure they'll get a lot more data on the Peruvian population. So this slide illustrates the distribution of these lineages, the A, B, C, D, and X, in populations divided on the basis of modern geographical location. Okay, so Central America, North America, South America. And what you can see is there are different frequencies of these lineages in Native American populations. You'll see up here in Alaska or in Greenland, it's really interesting. That probably suggests there was a very few Native Americans that got across to Greenland. I'm not sure why you would go to Greenland. It's a pretty nasty place for most of the year. Sorry, it's no offense to anyone that comes from Greenland. But that suggests that there was what they call a bottleneck. A small number got over there and they colonized it. And this gives you a clue why. Because the Eskimos in this area, who were the obvious ancestors, there's a lot of this, the A lineage amongst them in Alaska. So we look to Asian populations. These lineages also occur in most Asian populations. What's interesting, though, it's not the same sort of distribution. You see some populations that don't have one, like these up here in Northeast Asia, the A lineage. They haven't found the X for one. They haven't found the B lineage. But the B lineage occurs in Asia. The population that they've found, all of the Native American lineages found amongst Native Americans, comes from Central Asia. In fact, they come from a region just around Lake Baikal. Okay, so the populations in blue are populations where they've found Native American Y chromosomes. Okay, the Y chromosomes found amongst Native Americans. Populations in pink are where they found highest frequencies of the A, B, C, D, and X lineages amongst Native Americans. And the Altaian population is the only population where they've found all of them. So they have female and male lineages. So it's a very interesting population. And what this suggests to the scientist is that while the ancestors of the Native Americans may not have originated from that area, the Altaian population, their ancestors, wherever they lived 15,000 years ago when Native Americans left, they were clearly both very closely related. So if I now switch, coming from Australia with lots of Polynesian members, I've always been very, very interested in the molecular evidence concerning Polynesians, and this is really quite a fascinating story. Because Polynesians, their mitochondrial lineages belong to the B lineage family, okay, which is found amongst Native Americans. You can see the B lineage occurring all over the place. But remember, the B lineage also occurs here in Eastern Asia. So where do they come from? Well, scientists have looked at the mitochondrial DNA of these B lineages amongst Native Americans, and they've found 2 to 3 spelling changes that are totally unique to Polynesians, but they also find them in Asia. Okay, it's called the Polynesian lineage. You can see that a lot of the Polynesian islands, there's been some very tight bottlenecks again. Only a few people have got through. The B lineage came. And you can see almost like a path through Southeast Asia. Polynesians are remarkable sailors, and you can see how they've taken the Polynesian lineage out into the Pacific. It's never been found, to the best of my knowledge, in Native American populations. Okay, just to summarize the data. Okay, amongst Native Americans, 99.6% of their DNA came from Asia. There's a smattering of European and African lineages. They're scattered over North America at very low frequency, and usually there are more of them in tribes that have had much more contact with Europeans since they arrived. And all of the scientists conclude that it's what they call admixture. It's just mixing of Europeans and Africans with Native Americans since Columbus. I mentioned that we can estimate how old the Native American lineages are and when was their common ancestor. And their common ancestor was probably in Asia. And that common ancestor lived roughly 20,000 years ago. That's what the DNA clock tells the scientists. Amongst Polynesians, all their DNA essentially comes from Southeast Asia. So there's no doubt, in my mind, that Native Americans and Polynesians are descended from Asians. There's no shame in that. Native American males. On the male side, about 90% of their Y chromosomes of Native Americans are derived from Asia. They find the same Y chromosome amongst Siberian populations. There's a much higher European presence. I guess you can all understand why. Promiscuous males. There are a lot more males in the first parties that arrived in the Americas, and they went a long way. And they sowed their wild oats all over the place. But among the Y chromosome is probably a little bit more accurate as a molecular clock than the Y chromosome because it resembles the chromosomes. They have so much data on the chromosomes that they have a very good idea of what sort of rate they accumulate spelling changes. And so they're mostly derived. I think that estimate is probably more accurate than the mitochondrial DNA. So again, with Polynesians, they're not derived from Israel. They're linked to Melanesian populations, some of the Y chromosomes, but some of the Y chromosomes come from Taiwan and other Southeast Asian countries. So how does the DNA fit with other scientific opinion? And it's of no surprise, it doesn't really conflict. It's adding new information, but it doesn't conflict with 20th and 21st century opinion about the origins of Native Americans and Polynesians. But it does conflict with an interesting theory from the 19th century, which you may have heard of. This is the mound builder myth. This arose because the pioneers crossed the Appalachian Mountains and they found these earthworks, which were just extraordinary. Some of them were very large, but there were thousands of them. Thousands. They couldn't believe that these Native Americans, who by that time had been decimated by disease and were just the ragged remnants of many populations, were sort of gathering in the Ohio Valley, destitute. They couldn't believe that they made these things, and so this myth emerged. And I have no doubt whatsoever that this is what Joseph Smith latched onto. Because for most of the 19th century, this is what the scholars believed. Okay, not just the radicals, but it was the common opinion of the time. So they didn't believe they could build these earthworks, and they didn't believe that they could make these beautiful artifacts that they were uncovering in some of these earthworks. So this is fascinating history. If you want to read more about American history, it's really fascinating to read about the mound builder myth, but also the fascinating cultures, very, very advanced cultures that were present before Europeans arrived. But in the 21st century, I just want to talk about just a couple of pieces of evidence that have been really important for the development of what I refer to as a theory, but I would say that there are many scientists who have zero doubt now that this is what took place. I guess the most persuasive evidence that scientists have is the appearance of stone points all over North America. And they appeared about 13,000 to 13,500 years ago, all over North America, pretty much all of the North American states up into Canada. But so for a long, long time, it was believed that Native Americans arrived around about 13,500 years ago. But the difficulty that scientists had was that they had a fair amount of evidence that the ice sheets during the last ice age were pretty much closed up prior to about 13,500 years ago. Okay, so either the Native Americans got in here overland and very rapidly populated the whole country, or they found some other way to get here. I would say about 10 years ago, the prevailing opinion was that they came through a corridor in the ice. But the molecular evidence and evidence that they discovered in Monte Verde that suggests that Native Americans were there 14,500 years ago has made scientists have to come up with a slight revision of the theory, and that is coming via a coastal route. Okay? So they suspect that they probably sailed around, but came from the same populations but sailed along the coast into the Americas. So that's, I guess, the current state. They believe that they arrived before 15,000 years ago. That would be the current opinion amongst scientists. So they may have arrived 20,000 years ago, but probably not a lot before then. In Polynesia, the scientific evidence is fairly clear. Pottery, related pottery on a lot of the islands suggests related cultures. That selects related cultures, so it suggests related people. And Polynesians were outstanding sailors with these outrigger canoes, and they got around the Pacific. They colonized much of the Pacific in about 1,000 years. It's a remarkable story. And their languages are very, very closely related amongst Polynesians. And they're related to Micronesian populations, getting less and less related as they go back into Asia, so it fits with the the DNA evidence and the other evidence that scientists are looking at. I guess for the remainder of the time, how much time have I got, Sue? I can race through this. Okay. part of the problem is this, I click this and nothing happens. I'm not going to answer all the apologetic claims over the last 3 years because they run into the thousands. They just rattle them off all the time. There's huge papers and they're full of criticisms of the science and all sorts of things. But if I was to summarise the current situation amongst most of the scholars, they concede now that the majority of Native Americans have Asian ancestry. A lot of their apologetic effort now is in reinterpreting the Book of Mormon. Lehi and the Israelites made a minor genetic impact in the Americas. And they're also dismissing the statements of numerous prophets. I'm going to address this guy because he just published an article in Farms Review. He contradicts not only the critics, but most of the other apologists. He really gets stuck into me, but at the same time he's getting stuck into Farms because he criticizes the DNA, which they accept, and he believes that the DNA evidence supports the Book of Mormon, the traditional view. There's also Blake Osler with another theory. And Malaysia, and there's lots of other theories that are starting to emerge. And this is where we fall into the gutter of LDS apologetics. Okay, this might be true, but you don't need to tell everyone. I've written a response to Ryan, David Stewart. I hope that's not true. And I could rattle off. I should have Hamblin on there too. Some of these guys are just disgusting, the stuff they write. If you publish the sort of stuff they write in the scientific literature, you'd never publish again. They would blacklist you so quick. I think this is because they are so desperate to answer the criticisms that they're falling over themselves to write, and they're just not thinking clear enough. So responding to the apologists, I've actually written a response to Blake. That was actually quite disappointing because I don't believe that Sunstone now will publish anything in the DNA area. The editor of Sunstone, I think, has actually concluded the DNA evidence isn't terribly convincing. I've written a response to Farms and Fair, and if you want to see these sorts of things, go to the Signature Books website, buy a few of their other books. And you can look at my responses to Farms and Fairs. They're on there now, and I'll modify those and update them if anything else comes along. I've written a specific response to Ryan, and that's on the website as well. But I'm not alone in this. Thomas Murphy and Brent, it's great that Brent's here. I'm looking forward to hearing Brent speak. But they've done an enormous amount of work, and they've copped a lot of the personal attacks as well. But there are many others that are actively debating the issue, particularly online. And I couldn't list them all, but there are tons out there doing a really good job. But David Stewart's claim, I got David Stewart's paper as I stepped onto the plane, essentially. It was sent to me by Tom Kimball and Brent. So I had a quick look through this, and he makes this claim that because we don't have ancient Israelite DNA, we can't detect it. That's not the real problem. The real problem is we have so much Asian DNA. Got to get around that one first. But he's actually incorrect. A lot of Jewish populations have been DNA tested. Look at their DNA lineages. They fall into these classes. Okay? Look where the Native Americans are. And these ones aren't related. They're not the same others. Okay? So we know enough about Jewish populations. They're closely related to Europeans and other Middle Eastern populations. He claims that the two dominant Y chromosomes, two different Q lineages amongst American Indians, are present amongst Jewish populations at moderate frequency. It's false. 90% of Native Americans males have chromosomes that are absent in Europe or present at extremely low frequency. And I happen to have a couple of the papers on my computer, so I, I copied a couple of the relevant bits of information. Here's this Q lineage. Look at them, Native Americans, 449 out of 588. One in Europe. Okay? They're all over North Asia, Central Asia, not surprising. There's another paper that I had similar to, there's an interesting question mark down there. here, Q lineage. American Indians, all these ones. African, zero. Europe, zero. Okay, I suspect he might have popped over a column and concluded this was a Q lineage. Simple mistake, but it's wrong. Okay, he's totally misleading, so he's got the data wrong. Here's some other interesting claims. He cites a paper that claims that the similarities amongst American Indian languages, as well as their DNA, point to the one conclusion that a very small group of immigrants arrived and they populated the country really quickly. Okay? That is total nonsense. That's the paper it came from. He's quoting that from that paper. Okay? Native American language is well known amongst those who study Native American languages. They're enormously diverse. Even amongst Mayans, there's 60 languages. Okay? There are many languages that are totally unrelated. And that's because they've been here so long. 15,000 years ago. You can't find significant similarity between languages over about 5,000 years. And that's precisely why there's so this enormous diversity amongst Native Americans, because they've been here longer. Okay? Ridiculous claim. But he might have this one right, and I can't argue with it. Okay. He has anecdotal evidence that more patriarchal blessings of Mongolians reveal more different Israelite tribes. Okay. He stresses in the paper it's not really strong evidence, but not scientific evidence at least. So anyway, I might skip over this, and I'll go straight on to some limitations of the limited geography, but one of the big problems for the limited geography is the narrow neck of land, which a Nephite can get across in a day and a half, is now 125 miles. West Sea is south, basically. East Sea is essentially north. We've got Second Hill, Cumorah. Big problems. There's lots of other problems all listed there, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with them. I guess one of the ones I want to point out, I guess the major one is that all of this stuff here that the apologists are coming up with, there is no official endorsement. Even the stuff that's on the web, no official endorsement. They're distancing themselves from what they want it out there, so people can just look to see all those links and say, yep, that's enough. Don't read the links. Because what those guys say is they contradict most of the things that the prophets are saying, including Joseph Smith, who was fairly explicit. He had no doubt where Native Americans came from. Principal ancestors were Israelites. And the remnant of the Indians that now inhabit this country. Okay? And this is the apologist's response. Joseph Smith was talking about a small subset, not everyone. Okay? I might even end with this one. This is an absolute classic. This is an email that a friend of mine who's left the church got from a friend of his in response to hearing that about the DNA. Okay? He hasn't read anything that I've written, but he's very familiar with it because he's read the farm's responses. Okay? I'm taking a typical anti-Mormon approach, and that's what I got labelled as an anti-Mormon within weeks of just saying, guys, there's a problem here. Okay? He thinks it's only the ones that are educated. But this is really a classic. Yes, we've had to change our view. Well, that's sort of why I'm raising the argument in the first place. It pays to keep an open mind and be objective. That's good advice. I might take that advice. I might sort of... I've sort of alluded to it during my talk. Okay, Native Americans got here 15,000 years ago. The scientific evidence for that is just as conclusive as the fact that they came from Asia. Okay, there's no doubt among scientists now that Native Americans originated. Their ancestors lived in Asia 20,000 years ago. Okay, so that may be a bit more uncomfortable for some folks in the room. And it does challenge some other beliefs. There's no support at all from the DNA evidence that there was ever a single man and a single woman on the Earth. There's support that there was a small groups of humans, maybe as few as several thousand, but there's no support for a single... If we'd had a single man and a single woman, you think about those mutations and how frequently they'd occur in their children, assuming they weren't... Well, I guess some people may argue that they didn't have any mutations and they occurred subsequently, but there's, you know, the DNA evidence is very conclusive to me, at least, and many, and the majority of scientists, that there's no evidence for a single man or woman on the planet in our history. Nor for a universal flood, the thing that bugged me right at the beginning. And DNA evidence is entirely consistent with evolutionary theory. And I emphasize theory, because theory means a different thing to scientists than it means to the large majority of the population. A theory amongst scientists is something that has been proven over and over and over and over again to be entirely consistent with the evidence available. Okay, scientists are skeptical all the time. So even though it's a theory, they're just continually searching and refining, but it's entirely consistent with evolutionary theory. In fact, it's the mechanism underlying it. That's how it occurs. But none of the above is necessarily an attack on religion. Okay, I know a lot of Christians in Australia, even in my family, who don't have any huge problem with accepting evolutionary theory, or that there was an Adam and then Eve on the earth 6,000 years ago. So I don't see this as a huge threat, and so do many Christians. I think it's more so the case in Australia than in the US. I think there's the US you have a very, oh, this is a real hassle, this seems, I click it and nothing happens. You may have heard of intelligent design. This is the one, this is all the scientists really get really fired up about intelligent design, trying to say that science, through the gaps of our science, trying to say, well, science doesn't have all the answers, so there's not enough evidence to prove that there wasn't a single man and a woman on the earth 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. It can't be reconciled with the DNA. Okay, but that's not necessarily saying that you can't have a Christian faith. Okay, so I don't want to get bogged down in debates about intelligent design. But unfortunately, I think that's my last slide, so it might prompt some of you guys to get after me. Yeah, that's my last slide. So I might finish there. I better finish there soon. But I'm quite happy to answer any questions, even my excommunication. Somebody might be prompted to ask about my excommunication.
We're not recording.
There we go. Sorry. I've got a long, so I can't run. No. Let's put that cap on. Actually, I might leave that on because I may have a slide. I don't know. I've got about 300 slides, but I did have a gap.
You got a microphone?
You might be interested to know that as we speak across the road at the Red Lion, they're having an archaeology in the Book of Mormon conference.
Oh, I didn't know that.
My own observation has been that the word Lamanite has not been uttered in general conference for at least 10 or 15 years. And whereas back, my childhood experience was there was no doubt that the American Indian were Lamanites. And we don't hear that anymore. There's no overt acceptance of the farm's policies and the new theology coming out of there. But there, I have the suspicion that Farms is kind of acting as a front man for the church, that at one point in time, if they can deny that God was once a man and we're supposed to become gods, at some point in time, is it possible, do you think, that we're going to be saying something entirely different about the Lamanites? Farms has already retreated from the Americas to Guatemala, and so my next question, where are they going to retreat to now?
It's inevitable. I think it's going to be a long time. I think the last time Lamanite was mentioned, I think I'm getting feedback here. Okay. Lamanite was mentioned specifically in several temple dedicatory prayers in about 1999, 2000, by all members of the current First Presidency. But I think that I think they won't use it anymore. They'll phase it out.
Well, like a few years ago, when I was in the branch presidency, or just prior to that, and I found out later that it was just after the Thomas Murphy article, but I didn't know about any of that stuff. I mean, I was still like, you know, gonzo, church member and everything. But a circular came around that they read in church that instructed members of the church to cease using the term Lamanites. And so I've mentioned that a couple times, and I haven't been able to get a copy, and I know that I wasn't hallucinating. And my cousin's dad is the state president, and his dad confirmed that a letter like that had come around, but I haven't gotten a copy yet.
I think it's Steve Powell here. Steve Powell is ex-Mormon up in Portland. I'm pretty sure he went to a meeting, a priesthood meeting, where they had farms people there, and they were talking about the limited geography. And I wouldn't be surprised that would have been a forum where they would have sort of perhaps counseled you to back off.
I thought it was like just another politically correct thing. And then afterwards I realized that it's kind of a whole thing.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm one of those sitting in the back. A few nights ago there was a show on the Discovery Channel about, I can't remember what it was called, Where Were the First Americans From? Did anybody see that? I saw it. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I think I had a few beers. there was two guys from Canada from teaching from university, and their theory was that in Europe there the ice was pushing down further south, but the ice also froze over the Atlantic Ocean. And so as ancient man was searching in the ocean for food, they actually took their boats across the ocean and went close to this ice cap where they camped out and then ultimately went across to the Americas. And so their theory was that actually the Europeans were the first Americans. And so then at the end, it lasted 2 hours. At the end, they did DNA testing and said they found DNA, European DNA, in the American Indians, very little. But at the end of the movie, they did say that...
Was it about 0.4%?
It showed them, it showed the Europeans, you know, they, you know, did a reacting. At the end, they showed them meeting up with the Asians and going, oh, hi. So they did assimilate with the Asians, but I wondered if what you thought about that.
I mentioned the X lineage. Is that feeding back a little? Okay. When scientists found the X lineage, they got excited about that one because it was occurring a lot in North and Eastern North America. It was more common amongst Native Americans there. And the X lineage also occurs in Europe at a very low frequency. So they thought that might have been a sign of European colonization. But the most closely related X lineages, to Native Americans, I'm pretty convinced are in Asia, so in Central Asia. So I'm not aware of anything that's been published that supports European entry from the East. My biggest problem there is that coming from the West, they were traveling along, sure, there were a lot of ice around, but they were traveling on the edge, the coast. And all along the coast, there would have been land. They wouldn't have been living on ice. To get across from Europe, they would have been living on ice and fishing straight out of the water, and I think it's just, and it would have had to have been so early, I just think it doesn't stack up. I think it's very, very unlikely that they came that way.
I was just going to say, the BBC did us a whole program about that, the Sulistran people from Europe.
Were you aware of...
The Salutrian
people. Yeah, and they had taken a look at the Inuit in the Canadian Arctic and in Greenland and just how they can exist out on the ice floes, hunting a whale, et cetera, and live, you know, for extended periods of time. So, and it was tied in with the Clovis It's on the BBC's website if anyone wants to reach out.
I'm still quite skeptical of that because Greenland, which is, you know, right up there, right on route, there's nothing. They're all, you know, Asian lineages. So I would have thought if they got there, you know, and somebody else arrived, they would have killed them rather than them being killed. So I'm just sort of, that's my sort of, you know, my reaction, I guess, to that. Sorry, I talked too long.
Okay. Quickly, I need to tell you that the bartending class is closed. I did put out an email a week or so ago about it and asked people to email me, and it filled up within about 3 hours. So those who notified me, that will be upstairs in room 924. And as soon as we separate here, you can go on up for that. And we're going to be closing this room off so that Blair's presentation will be in this section and Arth Evans will be in the back. And that's how that will go. Can you give me your name again?
I'll be going about 9.
This is Evan Mark. You want to stand up for a minute? He is doing a documentary interviewing returned missionaries. And if anyone is a returned missionary and would like to speak to him about that documentary or would like to be interviewed,
put them on a microphone.
They're here. I thought you told me last night you just wanted people to be
here. For the last 2 years I've been working on a documentary called Memoirs of a Mormon Missionary, which is it chronicles my experiences missionary in the Good Spain. And I've also spoken with several other returned missionaries who had severely negative experiences in the mission field, unsurprisingly. Now I'm working on what I hoped for this conference was to speak to some of the people, speak to anybody of you out there who have had emotional difficulties. I was going to document that, and I hope it doesn't conflict with the other documentaries here.
The one that we're doing is sponsored by the foundation.
Well,
Okay, Lou?
You want to talk to him first?
I did speak to him last night, but then I began a piece of paper with these sort of questions.
Yeah, this is definitely the year of the video documentary.
It's not easy to say, Madison.
Sponsored by the foundation. There's another group here, Will Harbinger, and the two guys that are doing it.
Well, what's the problem? Yeah.
He should be in Milling about, and they may approach him.
I'm going
to
do an interview with them. I might just say, look,
they're doing a documentary also. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that there's this more focused on Mormons who, people who have left Mormonism and gone to Christianity. But you'll have to clarify that with them. But they will be milling about if you write it, or they're looking for people to interview. They're going to be interviewing across the street at the coffee shop. So you might even want to wander over there and see if you can get another interview. Sure.
Yeah.
Also, I'll reiterate again that the documentary that we are doing through the foundation, we're still open to people who would like to be interviewed and tell their story. And as I described last night, it's not the kind of an interview where you're going to be given a whole bunch of questions to answer. It's a pretty free-flowing thing where you're able to just tell your story and what parts of it that you'd like to talk about. So if you're still interested in that, contact Jerem, hold on a minute, or me, and Lou.
probably, I used to say I was not optimistic, agnostic.
Yeah. We really do need that.
I really think at some future date we ought to do a documentary solely on women's issues,
including Mormonism and the Anglican Church. I think it'd be a great idea. Yeah. Was there a question?
Do you hold this?
If you want to put that in your story, that we'd love to have some of that in there. Some of the consequences. Yeah, definitely. Those stories are what are part of the whole picture of what it is to have been a Mormon and Catholic. So. All right, we're going to separate. The next session starts in about 10 minutes. So particularly the bartending people, you need to scoot right up there because he's ready for you.
So it's, for me, that's not...